This week on the PhD Cast, we're talking neuroscience. What can brands and marketers learn from developments in neuroscience to tackle misattribution and make the most of their distinctive assets? All that and the state of origin, all the numbers from TV and the Twitter sphere from the big game last night. This is the PhD Cast from PhD Australia. Hey, it's good to be back. Thanks for listening to PhD Cast. This week, I'm Chris Stevenson. Well, every week I'm Chris Stevenson. But this week I'm Chris Stevenson and I'm joined by PhD Cast regulars. Lauren.
Hello.
Emma.
Hi.
Angela.
Hello.
And Casey.
Hello.
Awesome job the last few weeks.
Thank you.
How was it?
We missed you.
An adventure.
We missed you a lot.
I'm sure that's not true.
We did.
Well, you managed to sing Admirably. Thank you very much for my little song. That was very cool. I loved it.
Just don't make that a mandatory every week that we have to sing.
Yeah.
Well, too much pressure.
I'm not sure we'd put...
I'm not sure we'd put both
our listeners through that. Right, let's get on to it. This morning, Peter Pinter from a company called NeuroInsight was in conversation with our MD, Toby Hack, and a whole bunch of us and our clients to talk about neuromarketing and the implications for what we do and how we do it. The point of that, I suppose, was that the way advertising works is through emotion, and the way advertising works is through memory encoding. And through not only building but maintaining associative networks, which is how brands exist in brains. We talked about that. We talked about the dangers of misattribution and how neuromarketing and neuroscience can be used to combat misattribution. And we also talked how that can have implications for efficiency, but more importantly, effectiveness of advertising, and not just efficiency. I thought it was a great session with Peter and our clients. What were your guys' main outtakes from the session? I mean, what did you guys take away from that conversation that Toby had with Peter and our clients?
I think one of the most important and one of the most exciting things about was, and it was really good as well because it kind of strengthen what we are anyway talking when we are mentioning to clients things about distinctive assets, for instance. And what I really liked is they have a really interesting method to actually map these distinctive assets. Also, they call it the iconic trigger within one particular content, and then take that iconic trigger, because that particular content might just live in an audiovisual environment, and take that iconic trigger into different environments, so create consistency, and not only consistency, but basically effectiveness of the message.
And I suppose for anyone who's listening who isn't massively familiar with neuroscience during marketing, which I'm guessing is most of the people listening, I know that we've got a very big listenership amongst the newer marketing community. But for those of you who aren't, I mean, I suppose we're saying the a distinctive asset or an iconic trigger, PhD call it a distinctive asset, NeuroInsight call it an iconic trigger, is anything that is massively associated with a brand. So it could be a color, it could be a sound, it could be a logo, it could be a shape. And it's about understanding how they're communicated, right?
Exactly. And in this context, I mean, what they are doing actually, how it works, is they are monitoring our brain waves. I hope I get it completely right, but anyway, we're going to get a call from Peter that we are saying bullets, but I don't think so. That basically, they are monitoring how brain works, and what Peter mentioned quite a lot of times is that they are aiming at long-term memory, and what are these moments within one particular content as well that have a memory peak. So it ultimately means that these peaks are becoming these iconic triggers, which ultimately means that these are the ones that we actually remember from that particular content. And this is why we should be using that in other...
And again, we should probably say and explain that when Peter talks about measuring memory encoding, he literally gets people in a room, gets them to absorb communications in the way they would communicate them with a at home or wherever it is, and then they measure brain activity, different parts of brain activity, to get a read of left brain, right brain, exactly. So the extent to which those things are being encoded into memory.
I guess what he's saying is it's a more effective way of ascertaining whether something's successful, because it transcends, you know, it's underneath the surface. It's things that you are not aware of. It's subconscious. Instead of doing a lot of pre-research or post-research on the efficacy of some ad and asking people questions.
Yes, yeah, so based on the conscious.
It's based on the subconscious.
It's really objective measure.
You can't help the way you feel about something. It's the way it affects your brain. And I think that's quite an interesting way of approaching these things. So I think one of the what we didn't do this morning, but what I think is would be useful when you're talking about this, is to look at those examples of creative that has a real impact on people's emotions and how they feel about a brand, but which mightn't have been necessarily picked up in a normal kind of focus group environment, the old school research way. So the example that I was talking to him about was the Cadbury Gorilla, the UK Cadbury Gorilla TVC, which, had it gone through the normal kind of pre-testing, the old school pre-testing, you know, here is an ad about chocolate, but it features a gorilla playing Phil Collins in a room with very little branding, and, you know,
that's a crazy idea. It'll
it's
never
a crazy
work.
Crazy idea. It'll never work. But actually, when they put it through Neuro, it tested really well. So it didn't test well in the old school research sense. It tested really well in Neuro because people were having this emotional relationship with this content, and apparently that was what drove its efficacy. Not because logically it worked. On paper, it was probably a disaster of an idea. But emotionally and from a neuro perspective, it was really effective. So I think that's where it kind of has a practical application, seeing how things differently affect you.
I think they, I mean, he talked a lot about sort of measurement as well, like sort of post-campaign measurement. But somebody in the audience brought up the great point of, okay, can you work from this from the very start? Which that's sort of a great example as well, the Cadbury one, of kind of, can you get, you know, talking about the very sort of storyboard script phase, how important that is, rather than say going ahead with a large scale production and what he called sort of staying with your sort of status quo and things like that, and then taking some learnings later on. It was quite an interesting sort of application to sort of do it from the very beginning rather than just a pure measurement tool, but using it as part of your creative planning and stuff like that is what I thought was quite good.
I think the thing that hit home for me, and it's been something that I've seen from a, I guess, old school traditional research a few years ago, is the, I guess, the main meaty part of the discussion about misattribution. And going, kind of touching on the distinctive assets that everyone was talking about, is I've worked on some clients where they had an idea of what their distinctive assets were, but really there was a larger brand in the market that had the red, white, and blue colors as well, and they thought they owned, you know, blue or whatever, but it actually was attributed to a different retailer. And so therefore, all the advertising was being misattributed. And to his point, in terms of everyone going, it's end of financial year sale, it's end of financial, everyone goes out with that. So there's no cut through from that perspective. So really thinking about those distinctive assets and what you're trying to align yourself with is not only looking and saying, making sure that, do I really own that distinctive asset, or is this something that my competitor actually has a lead on and will I just spend my marketing money to drive there? Or to his point later, when somebody asked whether it could work the other way, is, okay, what can I actually maybe pull from a competitor by using a distinctive asset that I actually have more control over, but that they're going to run their advertising against. So I thought that was quite fascinating to kind of get the neuroscience confirmation of what we've kind of seen a little bit in traditional research, and maybe just getting a little bit more weight behind that aspect.
And of course, if you're Mark, I think it's a great point. And for me, the whole angle on being able to quantify and therefore objectively approach and tackle and defend against misattribution is probably the most powerful thing right now. as well as and using distinctive assets to do that, it is essentially the nub of this, and it's phenomenally important. I mean, even if you're the biggest player in a category and you've got stuff to gain by having a category play, if you're anyone other than category leader, you should be really, really nervous about doing anything that could do a category job rather than a job for your brand.
And I think what I also find interesting, what Laura mentioned as well and what you say as well, that we talk a lot about distinctive assets and iconic triggers actually being similar, but at the same time it also raises the question in this context, for instance, when you have a claim, end of year sales or whatever, that there might be an iconic trigger there within the piece of content, but you have already existing distinctive assets such as jingles or colors or whatever. And as to my understanding, how it can also work is, yes, it's really difficult to own that particular space or claim, but how it could work better is to actually, when you're trying to own that claim, you take your own already existing distinctive asset and make it sure that it really lands within that environment.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's not the best example to use something like end of financial year sale as a distinctive asset, because it's not, and you'd probably never want it to be. What it is, it's a need state. I'm looking to buy a car, and end of financial year is a really good time to do it. It's a need state. And so if you can connect your brand to that need state, happy days. But I'm not sure anyone would want to set out to own and or have end of year financial sale as a distinctive asset or an iconic trigger for their brand.
I think slightly going off the current topic,
what?
But back to what you were saying about the misattribution being the area to tackle, I think I'm coming from a digital background, coming from media agency, going, we optimize our placements within an inch of its life. And the next, I think, big area where clients need to focus on is optimizing the creative. So I think that using the services of NeuroInsight and companies like them to be able to optimize for a better creative cut through, because I think we've talked multiple times how creative actually has a much larger impact than necessarily the media placement itself. But having that be optimized is going to improve leaps and bounds what marketers are able to achieve, because we're getting to the point where we've gone as far as we can possibly go, or we'll make tiny, small, incremental improvements on things, but there's only so much we can do from a media placement perspective, and the creative message needs to start working harder.
Yes, but at the same time, you could argue that I totally agree with that, but at the same time...
I totally agree, but you could also argue...
But you could also argue that, sorry, that creative media...
I think one of those statements is true, one of them is let's keep going.
So from a media, you can also work, make media work harder. You can also make media work better and in a more creative way, because ultimately, what good creatives and I like to think that also good media, even if it's just a really smart placement or a really smart media idea, is doing is creating exactly that resonance. What Peter was mentioning, so actually, kind of forcing that it's going to be embedded into your long-term memory. So yes, I totally agree that the creative needs to work better, but I think this is also something that really clearly underlines what we always say about ourselves and tell that how important that whatever media ideas, whatever media executions we are doing, it actually has to have an idea behind it.
I think both of them together could still go quite a long way in sort of developing and becoming more sophisticated, because you're right, again, I agree with sort of, you know, creative executions, but we talk a lot about like sophisticated data and targeting, so I think that is a place where also our media placements becoming a lot more sort of personalised and targeted to people is where it could also grow into, as well as the creative becoming, you know, much better in that space as well.
But I think the question for me is, what defines good creative? the most effective creative, you could argue, sometimes, well, exactly, but sometimes is the most annoying. So for me, and I can talk about these brands because they're in the UK.
Yeah. Well, good creative is creative that works. I mean, we had a client presentation.
It's memorable.
Exactly. We had a presentation with the Ehrenberg Bass Institute, and they kept referring to the best examples. And I said, how do you define best? And they looked at me really blankly, and they didn't understand the question. And then they're all right. No, the best work is work that works, and that is what is best.
Because then, could you say, and I'll use two UK examples just because they're in my head. Would you say therefore that the Go Compare ads in the UK,
which is the opera guy for anyone who hasn't seen it.
For anybody who hasn't seen it. Are more effective and are effectively better creative than, say, the Sony Bravia ads, which had the do you remember the high-rise buildings exploding with colour and really beautifully made and really high production value commercials?
Yeah, well, I think it depends on the question you ask.
Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be, like, just because, we'll go slightly outside of advertising, but Blair Witch Project, I mean, that movie was a huge seller, but they shot it on Handycam. You know, like, it was
it's
like...
It's not just a matter of cost, though. I'm just saying, you know, when a load of industry people sit around a table, they'll talk about these very beautifully made commercials.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Awards, costs as well. Precisely. But which is the more effective? Is it the really annoying? Like, at the moment, the GPAD for me is an example of an incredibly annoying campaign. Can I say that without getting myself into trouble?
Yes. You can say anything about getting yourself into trouble. That's not true, by the way.
Is it effective? Probably. Is it something I literally want to switch off when I see it now. It's gotten to that stage. But does that mean it's not effective? I'm not sure.
Well, I think, my take on that is that if, back to the example of Bravia and annoying opera singer, as UK examples, they're both equally effective. They've both been very successful campaigns. They work differently, they do different things, but I think they've both been accepted as very effective campaigns that worked. We'll move on from there. A big thank you again to Peter Pinter. He was Peter Pinter. The company is Neuro Insight. And a big thank you again to Peter for his time this morning at PhD Conversations. Right, let's move on. Last night saw State of Origin. It's our Super Bowl, everyone. And the Super Bowl's go, it did all right. 2.5 million. Nothing to be shy at, and a whole load of social media in and around the event as well. Let's talk TV first. Christian, that's a sizable audience.
That's a huge audience, especially nowadays.
Nowadays, in this post-digital, post-fragmented world that we live in.
Exactly, in this fragmented world, especially in a market where everybody is, like, mostly out.
Sweeping generalization.
So it's definitely a huge audience. It's a huge success for it, even. I think, although at the same time, to be perfectly honest, everybody was anticipating it, so they also had quite a huge, really impactful lead-up. So it was almost sure that it's going to be quite successful. And to be perfectly honest, it was the first time I've seen it here, so this is the first time I experienced it. And I have to say, I quite liked it as well. I quite liked lead-up. And we were just talking about it with Angela, that even if you don't like the sport itself, they created really interesting content around it and also made housewives interested in it as well.
Are you referring to me as a housewife?
I was
going to
say,
When I said it out, I knew already that
you
I'm going to be in trouble.
You are so on your own.
The fact that she's here means that she's not a housewife. But
I'm sorry. Just to get the lingo right. So I come from a different market.
It's too late for that, Christian.
I come from a different market, and we actually in general. So our main grocery buyers we call house vibes in general in the Hungarian market. Just say
I will defend you. I will defend you, even though.
Oh my God! I'm so gonna.
Dig yourself
out
of that hole now,
Chris. Yeah, first rule of hole digging. Know when you're in one and stop.
But I guess
the point well made is that there are very few occasions, and certainly sporting occasions, in Australia where you will punch through and get a mass mainstream anyone, no matter what their lifestyle of choice is, where you get a mass group of people tapping in. And instead of Origin, we've got very few of them, right?
Maybe The Voice final or X Factor final might be one of those, but there are comparatively few. You're right. It used to be almost, I mean, in the 70s and 80s, every Saturday night would be one of those moments.
You've got to listen.
I'm not saying that I remember everything from these particular eras. I am not.
Were you a housewife back then?
I am a 50s housewife in all but name. But what I'm saying is that, you know, those events are few and far between these days. So, you know, in Australia, you've got a couple of times during the year where literally everybody gathers around the television, be it in the pub or at home.
Yeah,
and nowadays you have the added layer of social and people are interacting and tweeting and you know, doing the second screen thing. So
yeah, and then the days of, you know, those multi-million
mass audiences,
they're gone and they're never coming back.
Yeah.
Although actually they come back in different ways. You get, I mean, can you argue that the House of Cards on Netflix is the new mass audience and new ways of getting mass audience? That's probably a whole other topic.
But something like a big sporting event like this does give you that big event TV moment, which doesn't exist across other categories.
But
reality TV is an
but
example.
Is it an event TV anymore, or is it more a media event which happens to be on TV but also other places as well?
Yeah,
and so, for example, we know that last night saw a lot of social engagement, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I was sort of following that activity in particular, of course. I know that I think at one point it
for no particular reason,
no, just for pure interest. But peaking around the sort of 3,000 tweets a minute kind of mark, and that's just looking at people that were using like the official hashtag and stuff like that. So the amount of conversation, and you know, we've talked about before, I think. Adding that almost entertainment layer as well as engagement, and you know, finding other people that got that interest, and other people from New South Wales that all get behind each other, Queensland, stuff like that. So making it, I guess, a bigger experience through that.
By any definition, 3,000 tweets a minute is
not
good.
Is that a lot? I mean, is that a lot?
Yeah. Certainly for the Australian market.
If you're following a hashtag, you literally would not be able to keep up with that. I mean, that's a good result.
Yeah. No, I think that's fine. I mean, there's obviously bigger things come up from, you know, big events in America and Super Bowl and stuff like that. But in the Australian market, that's a really sort of strong statistic.
And I love the idea there's official and unofficial. So basically, that's only the official conversation. So you could actually be having a whole conversation on Twitter. It would be unofficial because you're not hashtagging correctly.
How dare you not hashtag?
What drives that? Is it the state rivalry that drives the volumes that we see on Twitter?
I think so. I think it's just it's a place to, you know, as well as sort of being, I mean, if you're in the pub or you're at home and you're watching it, it's just another place to state your allegiance and kind of, you know, it's something we know that people are so passionate about, whether, you know, potentially even more so than sort of things like Rugby World Cups and all that kind of stuff. People get so passionate about the state that they belong to. So it's just a way to express it, I think, and get sort of, yeah, just involved in that conversation. I think what was interesting as well is that also, which I noticed last night, that level of conversation engagement was happening without any kind of encouragement from the network or the TV show. I mean, I was the person I was sitting there watching it with going, God, they could put hashtags on the TV screen, they could be doing this.
And they didn't.
So that was the level of conversation that was happening despite any kind of encouragement.
Well, I'm wondering why Nine wouldn't have necessarily done that as part of their official strategy. Why was that not done?
Probably they thought that housewives are not hashtagging.
Because you know, housewives are just interested in these big, beefy guys, and that's the only reason you would ever watch State of Origin or any NFL, NRL. The sport correct, Angela? Get the country correct.
That's probably the point of draw things to it this week. A big thank you to everyone who's taking part this week. Thanks to Lauren. And Emma.
Bye.
And Angela.
Thank you.
And Casey.
Bye.
I'm Chris Stevenson. It's good to be back. Thank you for listening.
To get more from PhD Australia, you can like us on Facebook.
You can follow us on Twitter or find us on Google Plus at PhD Australia.